Hey there, Josh. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Glenn. How are you doing? We haven't talked for a while.
I know. It's been a while, and all these things are going on in the world.
I miss
our conversations. But, yeah, here we are.
Yeah, babies have been born, and, you know.
How's that again?
I'm sorry, we're having a little sound trouble here. I say babies have been born, and
you
know, people have been beaten up, and
political,
you know,
candidacies
have been committed, and
come to an end.
That's right. It's been so long since we've talked that there hasn't been a primary.
Well, I think the very first time I came on Blagging Heads with you, and of course Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were competing, and you voiced your support for Obama, and I said something like, "Nah, I'm going with the grown-ups this time." By way of
the
indicating
A-team.
My support.
Yeah, you said the A-team.
The A-team.
You said the A-team, and now it looks like the I don't know if it's the B-team or the A. I thought they were the A-plus team. I thought the A, it looks like they're incorporating the A-team anyway.
I took flack. And I've been taking flack ever since, and I guess I have to eat crow. I mean, there isn't any way around it. And I've got to get myself on board fully and enthusiastically. And, you know, I gotta, having not drunk the Kool-Aid, as I was so used to saying, I've got to kind of get the religion.
Right. Well, we don't want you to get the religion or drink the Kool-Aid, but I think a little more enthusiasm, a little less skepticism, but I think there are enough Kool-Aid
I'm just wondering, is it possible to criticize Barack Obama if you're a good Democrat these days? Or does one have to... Didn't Ralph Nader... I actually didn't see it. Someone told me about it. Come out this weekend somewhere or another and attack him? Not that Ralph Nader is a touchstone of wisdom, but...
Right.
Is it possible to accuse Obama of flip-flopping without having joined the McCain camp? Is it possible to hold him to his promises, whether it be about campaign finances or anything else? Is it possible to say, you're moving so far right so fast on things like guns or FISA or whatever that you don't sound like you're, you know, either churlish and, you know, still nursing your wounds from the primary, or like you're giving aid and comfort to John McCain?
Yeah. Well, we're going to find out. We'll find out in this conversation if it's possible to criticize without being on the other team. But I thought we might just start one step back from there.
Yeah.
I know you were just out of the country, and we talk about that later on, what you're up to. But one of the things that came out while you were gone was a new report from the Physicians for Human Rights. And this was about torture of people held by the United States in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo. And the way the report worked was that these were, as I say, Physicians for Human Rights, and they did real kind of in-depth medical interviews with 11 people who had been held. And who gave testimony, which testimony was then, so far as is possible, verified through medical examination. They gave testimony to torture, including physical beatings, sensory bombardment, stress positions, including suspension, and abject humiliation. They're all suffering badly now, as you can imagine, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, etc., all innocent. And the thing that was most striking, startling, well, I don't want to say most, there were many things that competed for most, but there was a preface to the report that was written by retired Major General Toguba, who's the guy who did the Abu Ghraib investigation in 2004.
Yes, I actually didn't see the report, but I've seen press releases, including extensive description of this general's commentary.
Yeah, let me just read a little bit of it. It's not long.
By all means, go ahead.
Yeah, because I think it's very powerful. He says, the profiles of these 11 former detainees, none of whom were ever charged with a crime, or told why they were detained, are tragic and brutal rebuttals to those who claim that torture is ever justified. Through the experiences of these men in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo Bay, we can see the full scope of the damage this illegal and unsound policy has inflicted both on America's institutions and our nation's founding values, which the military, intelligence services, and our justice system are duty-bound to defend. In order for these individuals to suffer the wanton cruelty to which they were subjected, a government policy was promulgated to the field, whereby the Geneva Conventions and the Uniform Code of Military Justice were disregarded. The UN Convention Against Torture was indiscriminately ignored, and the healing professions, including physicians and psychologists, became complicit in the willful infliction of harm against those the Hippocratic Oath demands they protect. And here's the operational thing. After years of disclosure by government investigations, media accounts, and reports from human rights organizations, there is no longer any doubt as to whether the current administration has committed war crimes. The only question that remains to be answered is whether those who ordered the torture will be held to account.
Excuse me, you're still quoting from
This is all quotation from Taguba. There's no doubt, he says, that war crimes were committed by the current administration, and that the only remaining question is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account. He then goes on briefly to say that these people are fighting lonely and difficult battle to rebuild their lives. They require reparations, medical assistance, and official apology from our government. But most of all, these men deserve justice as required under the tenets of international law and the United States Constitution, and so do the American people. Now, this is... Taguba, as you know, is not a celebrity-seeking celebrity. He's a kind of, aside from being a retired major general, he's apparently, so the stories go, a pretty reserved guy. And he is making he's offering this very bracing statement that there's no doubt that war crimes have been committed, and that the only remaining question is whether these people are going to be held to account.
Don't we know the answer to that question, and that the answer is no, they are not going to be held to account? I mean, I ask you, what about John Yoo? I'm speaking of the Bolt Hall law professor who's become well known and has been talked about in some of the books that have come out since, for his role in the legal advocacy. And I mention his name because it's well known. There are others who could be mentioned. But my point is, do they get a civil reception in the halls of legal academia? Are they still tenured professors at major law schools and otherwise honored and honorable figures within their professions, or are they pariah who are seen for what they are, handmaidens of the perpetration of war crimes, who are treated the way you would expect people who have engaged in such behavior to be treated? Isn't it the former and not the latter?
It is the former, and I think that's the reason why they're entitled to a day in court and a fair procedure, which were the kind of thing that was not given to people who were held in imprisoned and tortured in Guantanamo and in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they're entitled to that, and we should be cautious. I think we should be cautious about the nature of the accusations until they've had their day in court, but they ought to have a day in court. That's what Taguba is saying. I think the probability of their having a day in court is kind of low, and I think the reasons, there are several reasons for that. I think obviously at this point it's the 1st of July, the current crowd is going to be out of power on January 20th, and so there isn't going to be, impeachment is not going to happen, although impeachment is probably not quite the right remedy for, there's a more severe remedy that's appropriate for war crimes, and if those accusations really stick. I think there's something that we, and by that I mean me and you and people in this country and elsewhere, I suppose, need to face, which is, all of us would like to move on. I think lots of people, probably the vast majority of people in the country, are really tired of the Bush administration, the Bush-Cheney years, and really looking forward to January 21st when you don't have these guys managing the country. And so there's going to be real, you know, a real sense of, I think there's going to be a real sense of relief, frankly, whether John McCain is elected or Barack Obama, that these guys are off stage. But I think we have to really, I think we have to make a decision about, you know, if there's something to what Taguba is saying, and I have no doubt that there's something to what he's saying. This is a serious guy. These people were tortured, and there was a policy that was announced from the top, and drawing out the connections is something that requires that's what maybe courts are good for. But we have to decide whether or not we are so exhausted by the awfulness of these characters and what they've done to the country and, frankly, to the rest of the world, that we just want to move on and forget about this, or do we want to take seriously the people that have been managing the country?
Josh, your voice is trailing off, and I'm not hearing you now.
People who've been managing the country, who've been elected by the American people, are guilty of war crimes, and if we really think that there's a decent prima facie case that they have committed war crimes, then I think it's very hard to just walk away from this. And even the issue is how they are held accountable. And there are several possibilities. One is that they're held accountable when they travel overseas, and that there's some country like what happened with Pinochet. So political officials who were arrested overseas under universal jurisdiction, and universal jurisdiction does extend to war crimes who are arrested overseas. And it would be interesting to see what the political reaction would be in the United States if George Bush or Cheney or Rumsfeld, for that matter, were arrested and charged with war crimes.
Yeah, I guess I'm giving evidence here of my skepticism that any such thing would be likely to happen. And if it were sufficiently likely that the perpetrators would put themselves in a position where such actions could befall them. And I do wonder about the political resonance of this issue and how it cuts. I mean, for example, can a candidate go out on the campaign trail now with this report in hand? Oh, let's just say the Democratic Party candidate, to pick a random one. And then begin to talk about the outrage, about the need for accountability, about how officials of our government ought to apologize. I mean, think about it. Apologizing to inmates at Guantanamo, apologizing to people kidnapped off the streets of wherever it was, Karachi or whatever, some of whom may have been linked or suspected of. You know, can such a candidate go and say, would there really be political accountability if we could put it to a vote of the American people? Because the defense would be, we did what we needed to protect you from a real threat. We've been successful so far, and that 9/11 hasn't been repeated. These are, many of them, very bad people. Put yourself in our position. What would you have done? Anything else would have been derogation of responsibility. To protect the American people, this kind of thing.
You know, what worries me about that, I agree with you on the diagnosis, and I don't think that this is likely to turn into a campaign issue, although I think this is what, you know, an independent media is good for. They're good for many things, but an independent media is good for keeping issues like this from disappearing from the discussion. And there have been some op-ed pieces about the Taguba report, about the Physicians for Human Rights report, and about Taguba's statement that certainly hasn't been as substantially covered as I think it might be. Andrew Sullivan has been blogging about it a bunch at The Atlantic, and I think he's been really been very strong on this issue. But
I was just going to ask a kind of more general question, which is, it seems to me some very reasonable ideas are too radical to discuss. So you said impeachment might not have been the best instrument, but it seems to me, particularly in light of what we know, it wasn't entirely nutty to talk about it. And yet if somebody like Dennis Kucinich or, I don't know, John Conyers or somebody were to utter it, you know, people's eyes would roll back and would immediately roll back in their heads. I mean, imagine a newspaper that reports after January 21st, 2009, former president and suspected war criminal George W. Bush spoke in Chicago today.
Right.
Well, you know, everybody would say that's way over the top, it's out of line, it's inconsistent with civility, decorum. No one wants to be wild-eyed radical.
Right, but now you do have this statement by a person who investigated what happened, who was you know, retired major general, retired because he was pushed out by these people. And I don't think it would be... it's the kind of thing where if enough people said suspected war criminal, and this, as I say, this is one of the things that an independent media is good for, then you keep the... you keep the suspicions and the accusations alive. I think. Look, the problem with what I know you weren't exactly defending the position that you were describing before about they, you know, we did what we had to do. Doing anything else would have been dereliction of duty. But the thing that I think we have to appreciate is that everybody. Ever who commits war crimes says exactly
says
that.
The same thing.
I mean, that's what Pinochet said. You know, it was a national security. The country was falling apart. It was a crisis. This was the salvation of the republic. It's what the Argentine, you know, general said. You know, they're back to war crimes. Torture trials in Argentina again. Now this is. You know, now 25 years later, and you know there is arguably in the Argentine case, you know, it's 25 years later. It's pretty hard to have fair procedure at that kind of distance. So there is a case for doing this earlier. But the thing that we have to come to terms with as we're thinking about this, really, there are these two points. One is, no matter where this happens, I'm sure everyone always wants to move on. And there's always a big public debate about whether we should move on and look forward to creating a better future or worry about some terrible deeds that were done in the past. And that the people who've done these things always have the excuse that they did what would seem necessary to them under the circumstances for the salvation of the republic. And doing anything less would have been a dereliction of duty. But there were some pretty bad things that were done to these guys. I really recommend that people... read the report, and I think and people have suffered some legal sanction. Look, of course, always at the the bottom of the food chain, they've suffered some legal sanction for what happened. But I think the real question here, and it's one that many people have investigated, but I think it really does require a more authoritative resolution by perhaps by a court, is whether or not whether or not this really was a case in which the orders came from the top. And that's what Toguba is saying, that he thinks that it's an open and shut case at this point. From his point of view, it's an open and shut case that they did, although you know, he's not going to sit in as a judge and jury. But maybe we should...
Do you agree with me that much depends on what the next president... and that administration decides to do and say about this.
Yes.
That is to say, the decision to move on or not is largely in the hand of the next administration. Not to say that they would necessarily initiate formal proceedings against people. I'm not sure. I'm not any lawyer at all, so I don't know quite how that works. But at a political level and in terms of public communication, in terms of revisiting the issue, in terms of apologizing for past behavior of our government, and in terms of underwriting social sanction, you know, people should be should lose face. They should lose standing. They should be repudiated.
Yes.
This is substantially, is it not, in the hands of at the discretion of the next political administration. So.
Yes. And there's an interesting question there, and I don't know, you know, we don't know the answer to it, which is, you know, this is what we get paid for, is, you know, probably make an equally good case that McCain is more likely to do it and that Obama is more likely to do it. McCain, because of his concerns about torture and his own personal experiences, Obama, because he's been a critic from the beginning of the policy, at least the policy in Iraq that led to some of this stuff. Although this,
I put it a different way, Josh. I'd say that Obama wouldn't necessarily have the strength and the standing to be able to do it, given that he would need to be very worried, I would think, about what the reaction would be from many quarters that might be rather skeptical about his capacity to effectively exercise stewardship in the area of military and national security affairs. Given that he's weak there, it seems to me it would be harder for him to take on something like this.
That may depend on who else is in his administration, Glenn. If you had a vice president like a Webb or a Sam Nunn, or if he did do what there's been a bunch of noise about recently, keeping Gates as Secretary of Defense. If Gates, in his capacity as Secretary of Defense, said made some comments about his predecessor Donald Rumsfeld having authorized torture, I think that would give Obama substantial license to do that. So I think it's going to depend, although I certainly agree with you that he's going to be worried, that Obama is going to have to be more worried about that flank than McCain is.
Now, so I have a dream. I have a, they say it's about hope now. I'm trying to get with it. I'm trying to get with the Hope Express here.
With the hope,
the audacity of hope. I'm trying to we are the change we've been waiting for. I'm trying to catch the
I hope I'm not the change I've been waiting for, because I just feel like I'm doing the same thing every day.
But in any case, I have a dream, and my dream is that somebody who is the commander-in-chief and the chief executive and the head of state would declare victory in the war on terror and get us out of this 100 years crusade that we seem to be slipping into against Islamic terrorism, and we're going to take it as a foregone conclusion that we need to have armies if occupation and control on the ground in populous Islamic countries for their foreseeable future as the only way to forestall terrorist attack. I feel that nobody in the campaign so far, with due respect, is saying anything like that. And maybe the political realities are that no one can. We're going to go into Pakistan with or without the government's approval, and we're going to hunt down Osama bin Laden. And, different candidates have different ways of saying this, to the gates of hell or whatever it is. And I just wonder, what? I mean, I ask myself, is it really that important that we have his head at the end of a spike at the end of the day? Years have gone by. There hasn't been any other attack. I'm not saying there's no threat out there, but I'm asking, must we really declare that to be our mission? Must we take this stance, this posture of, belligerence vis-a-vis? I mean, are we really going to take it on ourselves as our responsibility to manage, govern, and oversee the evolution of political development in Muslim countries? Is every madrasa going to be a target for our intelligence agencies? I mean, is this, we're not the state of Israel surrounded by mortal enemies who, in a kind of perpetual conflict, unless we cast ourselves in that light. Is it possible? I have a dream. Yeah. My dream is that a President McCain or President Obama would have the courage and the, wisdom to try to walk us back out of this perpetual stance of belligerence, out of this 100 years war that we seem headlong rushing into.
Yeah. Well, you won't be surprised to hear that I think there's a better chance of that happening with Obama than with McCain, although you may be surprised to hear that I think that it's not a shoo-in and a sure thing, because, I mean, I don't think of myself as somebody who's been consuming Kool-Aid, and I have my, in politics you should always be careful about, excessive enthusiasms of that kind.
I just want to say one thing, Jeff, and you go on, which is, no, I'm not surprised to hear you say that it's a better chance with Obama than McCain, but I'm not sure it's true, and it's the kind of Nixon goes to China problem. I mean, whereas maybe McCain could get away with it with the Joint Chiefs and whoever else, maybe Obama wouldn't feel himself capable of making such a radical departure from the conventional wisdom. But I don't want to be unfair to anybody here, right. So you know.
There are a couple of things I think that make a difference about the on the positions of Obama and McCain on these issues. The first is just generally on the importance of diplomacy, multilateralism, the kind of opposition to the kind of go it alone unilateralism that was particularly prominent in the first Bush term. I think there is some different that makes a big difference to how this conflict is conducted and managed, or how these relationships with that part of the world are conducted and managed. And, there was a statement that John Bolton, the former U.N. ambassador, crazy unilateralist, off the wall, I think it's really remarkable. So he said a couple of months ago, well, listen, Condi Rice has taken over, the State Department and Condi Rice have taken over, the Bush administration policy, but wait until January 21st. Now, this is Bolton, he's a blusterer. I don't think he's going to be John McCain's Secretary of State or UN ambassador, but there may be something that he knows that you and I don't know about the potential impact of people like him on a on a McCain foreign policy, which they're not going to have on an Obama foreign policy. And if you want to see the damage that kind of unilateralism can do, you just look at what happened in North Korea. You have a series of agreements, an effort to manage what's obviously a terrible, difficult relationship diplomatically. Yeah. The Boltons of the world come along, they bust it all up. North Korea goes out and gets develops some nuclear weapons, and now they've got enough fissionable material for about seven of them. And now there's an effort to walk back from there. But that's the kind of destructiveness that you get from somebody like a Bolton. And I think there is that element in the coalition that McCain is going to bring with him. That's a first point.
Let me ask you, go ahead. I'm going to just kind of play the naive person here. But, what about a nuclear-armed Iran?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, obviously, that's a bad thing. Everybody wants to keep it from happening.
Yeah.
Suppose diplomacy fails to keep it from happening. I just made my pacifist speech, no 100 years war. We can't take it upon ourselves.
You want to have a quick war.
Well, I'm not advocating anything. I'm really just trying to ask a question in a more or less naive way. Obama, as I understand, says, let's talk.
Yeah.
We should never be afraid to, negotiate and talk with our enemies. He says it's not a tolerable outcome that they should have nuclear weapons, but we're going to use diplomacy. I assume McCain is not against diplomacy, but there could be differences there, including differences in personnel, as you've been pointing to.
Yeah.
But suppose we find ourselves facing the imminent reality of the Israelis, this exercise that was reported in the press not long ago and so on. Facing the reality, another report I heard recently about we have intelligence agents on the ground in Iran who are actively investigating these possibilities, perhaps finding targets that might, etc. If this administration doesn't preempt and do something before they go out of power, wouldn't any new administration be confronting extremely difficult problems where military options would have to be on the table and dealing with the possibility of Iranians acquiring a nuclear weapon? And, with the Israeli interest and how that complicates, because they're free actors who are going to do what they think is best for themselves and so on. But they may nevertheless have implications for, the options that are open and the actions
by us. The Israelis have, independently of the United States at this point, the military capacity, the precision-guided munitions capacity that would...
Will you repeat that?
Yeah, sorry.
Did you say the Israelis have
that the Israelis have the capacity in terms of precision-guided munitions to take out the Iranian, nuclear potential, what's now a nuclear potential, and they're certainly making noises, very loud noises, like they're thinking of doing that, and there are a bunch of noises that are being made about how they're more likely to do it if it looks like Obama is going to be elected president, or if he is elected in November. There's a lot of time between the first Tuesday and January 20th, in which they can act and present the new administration with a very with a horrible situation. The problem is that the amount of there are many problems. A precision an attack that really took out the Iranian nuclear what's now again potential would have immensely destructive human consequences because of the location of the facilities that they would be required to take out. Maybe this will be a little bit goody two shoes here, but there are two points that I make. The first is that there is an initiative that's been undertaken by, among others, by former secretaries of state, including George Shultz and my Stanford colleague Bill Perry, which is really a zeroing out of nuclear weapons. And I think what they recognize is that it's really, it's very hard to tell countries at this point in history that we can have 10,000 and you can't have any. That you can preserve a little nuclear monopoly club, and it's a very difficult issue how you figure out what a zero regime looks like on nuclear weapons. But one way to make headway is to have that proposal really taken up and run with. And that may seem pie in the sky and very distant from this issue, but it brings me to a second point, which is there's not a bad case that that Iran is worried about a military attack, not just because of the nuclear weapons, but because they're sitting next to Iraq, long-term conflictual relationship, et cetera, et cetera. They're worried about an attack from the United States, accusations independent of the nuclear issue about helping the Iraqis, and their ace in the hole in terms of addressing that military pressure is that military threat is to have nuclear weapons, and so that the best way to deal with their move to get nuclear weapons is to relieve some of that pressure, and that's an argument. That argument about relieving the pressure is a position that's been taken by lots of important Iranian Democrats. I'm thinking, for example, of Akbar Ganji, who spent 6 years in prison, 70 days on hunger strike, or my colleague Abbas Milani at Stanford, who've basically said that the best thing for the Ahmadinejad regime is the American pressure. So, I think there are ways to, as the case of North Korea shows, there are ways to deal with this kind of, difficult relationship, but it goes back to this earlier point. What you have to do is be prepared to move forward, to take seriously issues of the complexities about diplomacy and the complexities of managing a multilateral coalition. I think Obama... So that's, I think, the plausible truth when Obama says, let's talk, not just horseshit.
I moved to ask here, and I'll get flack about it, but I moved to ask about the Israeli bomb. I mean, you make the point, zeroing out, and what do we have, 10,000 nuclear weapons, the United States, when the Cold War's been over for, a long time?
Yeah.
What about the nuclear weapons in under the control of the Israeli government? I mean, there's a long story, we can't necessarily retell it here, about how, the bomb was acquired and all of that, has that not set back the non-proliferation project considerably?
Absolutely.
And doesn't it give the pro-armament Iranians a very strong case to say, what? I mean, you're telling us we can't do what, you know, we're sitting here in this region, there's conflict everywhere, there, you know, we have to live under the, you know, potentiality of being threatened by people, and we can't move ourselves to a situation of parity vis-a-vis them. I mean, it, you know.
No blue sky on that issue, Glenn. I agree with you. I think yeah. What you have to do is, one of the things that you have to do, and I think this is your point, you're really underscoring the importance of this, is you have to ask the question, and it's, you know, it's to some extent a speculative question, but you have to ask the question, why do the Iranians want to have nuclear weapons? And one reason that they want to have nuclear weapons is because they feel themselves under threat. Now, I have no love for the Iranian regime. I'm not thinking, you know, gee, it would be great for them to be able to protect themselves. But, you know, we're talking about the realistic issues about internet. That's what they think, and you try to deal with that. That's what diplomacy is good for. That's what the Bush administration gave up on for the first 40 years.
But they are under threat.
Yes,
I mean, it's not just that they think
they
are. I think we can agree that objectively they are under threat.
Yeah, I know. I meant to say was they're under threat, and some people think, you bet your sweet ass they're under threat. They should be under threat. And I'm not going to get into that issue. I'm just saying, yes, they are under threat, and they perceive it, and they're not being lunatic, crazy, and paranoid in perceiving it, and so they're going to make efforts to deal with it. And then what you try to do, you can try to up the threat, you can try to destroy their response to the threat, or you can try to figure out some way to move around that to move around it. And that's what happened. I think the recent successes in the case of North Korea, which looked totally hopeless, I think may be in some ways exemplary. But let's shift topics here.
Okay, let's segue out of this.
We're getting deeper and deeper into a subject about which we've, I think, each exhausted what we know. We're going to embarrass ourselves.
Wasn't that much to start with.
Radical shift of topic. You were just away. Barcelona and someplace else talking about.
Yeah, I was in Edinburgh in Scotland at a conference last week, and then several weeks before at another conference in Barcelona. These were economics conferences organized by the, impressively strong and young and vital community of technical economics researchers in Europe. They're really quite good and very active on questions of social mobility. Both of the conferences, the one in Scotland, a group of researchers presenting mostly empirical papers where they've been trying to measure and deal with the conceptual definition of social mobility and then measure and compare across countries, the Nordic countries, Britain, France, Spain, Italy, and the United States. The other conference in Barcelona on the importance of social networks, where there were a large number of papers presented by people who are investigating in one way or another how social connections your ties, whether from the community you live in, your kinship network, what college you've gone to, the influence of family name, things like this, your position within social networks and how that influences economic outcomes, entrepreneurship, labor market, access to jobs, who gets to the top of the employment pyramid inside companies and things like this, importance of networks. So I came away invigorated. I mean, these are subjects I've been interested in throughout my career and very excited to see.
Well, let me ask you, Glenn. I think it's fair to say that I'm not going to read absolutely every one of the papers that was at the conference, and I'm not going to ask you for bibliography, not now anyway, but what were the, so there's a question about mobility in the United States versus mobility in Britain, Scandinavia, there's a question about changes in mobility in the United States over time. Those are two big questions anyway. What's the current thinking about those issues?
The U.S. is a less mobile society some ways than we might have thought. So, for example, you know, the correlation between social outcomes for siblings, brothers or brothers and sisters born within the same family in the United States is about 0.25. You can decide whether you think that's a large or a small number. About 25% of correlation coefficient is 0.25 is what I want to say. Genetics... what do people get from their families? So this was one of the subjects that was being talked about. Some of this correlation of social outcomes for siblings is engendered by the fact that they have the same parents or they enjoy the same advantages from the status of their family and so on. Some of it is generated by the fact that they have the same genes. This is an old and contentious question. You can't ignore genetic contribution to the similarity of outcomes of children born to the same family. Wherever Charles Murray is, let me just say that he's not wrong about everything. And it's unscientific and unwise, I think, in the study of these matters to take that off the table altogether. Now, I have not just said that inequality in the United States is justified by genetic differences. I haven't said that IQ is determined by what you get from your parents and has no environment. I haven't said that racial inequality is due to the fact that blacks are genetically sick. I haven't said any of those things. But I have said that if you're a serious student of social mobility in modern society, that's something that you would have to take seriously. And it's not a taboo dimension of research in this area, and people are talking about it.
So let me add, you said, if I...
Can I just say one other thing about what... There's much less social mobility for African-Americans than there are for other groups in American society. Black poor are much less likely to escape poverty. Black middle class are much more likely to slip back into poverty than is true for comparable whites. There's a much greater diversity of outcomes for blacks who have parents who have done relatively well than is the case for whites. So there's significant racial differences in the extent of social mobility or of opportunity in the society. Not necessarily due to overt discrimination, but in the data it comes out at the end of the day.
So you said it's the correlation as it was 0.25. So people, me and my siblings, all, as it happens, genetically related. It's people like in that position, about a quarter of the variation in how you fare in life is explained by is correlated with this family situation. But what about me and my next door neighbor? What about give me some way to think about, I don't know whether 0.25 is big or little.
Okay, so, your next door neighbor is going to be less, much less, but I actually don't have an accurate number that I can give you for the United States from recent data.
And how about over time? Is the United States getting less mobile? Does it vary? Do these numbers vary a lot over time? Is it becoming a more rigidly stratified place, or... has it been pretty constant over time?
Okay, so, a lot of this is constrained by the available data, and I have the impression that there's not a big trend in the United States. Well, this will be based on, for example, surveys like the panel study of income dynamics out of the University of Michigan, which has a very long cohort, very long period of observation of people from starting in the late 1960s and then following some of their children later on, and one can look to see directly across generations. And then you need more recent data to be able to answer the question whether or not mobility has risen or fallen, right? You need to be observed successive generations at one point in time, and then fast forward 25 years later and observe successive generations at a later point in time to be able to answer that question. And there are data in other countries that have permitted people to get at this. So in Britain, which was at the Scotland Conference, of course, a subject of some point of some discussion, the controversy was precisely over whether or not social mobility seemed to have gone down over the last generation or not, with the evidence being mixed but seeming to point in the direction of less social mobility the present time than was the case 25 years ago. I'm just not sure whether or not that's true for the United States.
So this is much more. This is a much trickier thing to study than income inequality. I mean, trickier issues about conceptualization, measurement. Trickier than income inequality.
Yes, because you're asking about transgenerational dynamics, so you need better data over a longer period of time to be able to get at it. One thing that came across clearly to me, though, is that the concept of equal opportunity, which you political philosophers throw around with such ease, is very fraught and difficult one. And another thing which is to say, it's not even clear exactly what you mean by that, because you can equalize formal opportunities until the cows come home. You can spend equal money on the education of people. You can, open up access to higher education. You can have anti-discrimination, anti-glass ceiling, and all of this kind of thing. But the informal influences on opportunity are very powerful, and many of them, those that are mediated by family relationships, for example. I'm proud to say that my wife, Linda Lowery, an economist at Tufts, presented a paper on grandparents, where she's used American data to show that there is an influence of the status of grandparents on the achievement of grandchildren independently of what grandparents' status tells us about what parents may be able to do for their children. Grandparents spending time with grandchildren has significant effects, she's able to show. But my point is, these are aspects of opportunity that no one's going to be able to equalize with any policies that respect individual freedom. We think people's autonomy in their family associations is sacrosanct, as well we should, in a free society. But opportunity travels along the synapses of those family networks.
Well, if I remember a comment once made by Glenn Lowery earlier in this conversation, about 25% does. That looks like...
Okay, so what about that other 75%?
What about that other 75%? That's a pretty big... Boy, not that that is a completely manipulable lever, but that looks like, for quality of neighborhood, I'm guessing that's one factor, quality of schools, training programs, quality of health care, that looks like a pretty big... lever if you're interested in doing something about creating greater intergenerational mobility. Though, of course, creating greater intergenerational mobility does mean, mobility downwards as well as mobility upwards. The numbers on, I mentioned that. Yeah, go ahead.
I think the point you're making, I think, is very important, and it did come through somewhat in the conferences that I was attending, which is that while the structures of social mobility are governed in part by informal interactions, which are only with difficulty made the subject of policy, they are also influenced in powerfully by formal interactions, including the investment of resources in human development through institutions of education and job training and such, which are a fit area for
policy. That's why there are liberals and conservatives around, because the conservatives emphasize the first point, that the transmission of opportunity comes through these densely complicated informal networks, and they're really you can't make those the subject of political manipulation,
right.
And then the liberals and progressives and people more on the left come along and think and emphasize the other part of the story, and then we social scientists come along and say, it's complicated, and then because we said it's complicated, we're excluded from the public conversation, except on Blogging Heads, where we're allowed to say that these things are complicated.
Well,
but I think it is it's important, particularly for the the kind of control freaks among us, whether political or personal control freaks, to recognize that there is a substantial component, let's say it's 25% of these issues about the transmission of mobility across generations, transmission of opportunity across generations, it's not subject to, not subject to control.
Well, I want to say a couple of things. One is I do feel a little bit of the audacity of hope, inspirational feelings, when I think about candidate Barack Obama in this context, because in his book, his campaign book, The Audacity of Hope, he has a chapter on opportunity, which reads very congenially to my mind, I must say.
How is that?
I mean, he says there, he doesn't go as far as I'd like him to go, but then he's running for president, and, you know, I'm a professor at Brown, so those are different occupations. But he says, we could spend a lot more money effectively on education. He says, you know, there are two schools of thought here. One is money is the only thing we need. The other is, predictably, he says this, the other is that money doesn't do any good. And he says a plague on both your houses. Money does do some good, but it's not the only thing we need because you could throw money down the sewer. But he sounds congenial to my way of thinking in that chapter. I mean, he says, why shouldn't the best teachers be making $100,000 a year or more?
I see. I didn't know that it was that close. I didn't know it was that close.
That sentence is in the book.
I didn't know it was that close to home. I mean, if the
he says, for those whom we entrust with this awesome responsibility of educating our young people, those who have demonstrated themselves, and he has a long byplay discussion on accountability, how you would measure performance, why some teachers object to using test scores as the sole instrument of evaluation because it's not something they have complete control over, and so forth and so on. But at the end of the day, he says, for those who've shown themselves to be masters at this very important task, why shouldn't they be making six figures? Heck, six figures is not even a large salary in some precincts anymore these days. I think that's fair. I mean, I've thought for a long time that if we took the idea of equal opportunity seriously, we'd be prepared to spend more money per pupil on the education of students who are in the most disadvantaged parts of our society. As it is now, we don't do that. We spend less. You know, some of the state constitutions, like in California and elsewhere, have been interpreted to require that there be equal spending on per capita on students regardless of the you know, wealth of the districts that they may reside in, but nobody is saying what I think could plausibly be said, which is that the public responsibility to invest in the human development of children is even greater for the children who are, you know, bereft of all the beneficial influences of successful parents and stable families and stable neighborhoods. We definitely reap the consequences of not making that investment when we have to incarcerate or we have to deal with other aspects of social failure that, you know, are associated with, you know, not making those investments. So I think that that case could be made, and it could be justified on principles of equality of opportunity, taking a compensatory view that the public responsibility is ratcheted up when the background conditions of the individuals in question are most disadvantaged.
Yeah, I think that the crucial issue there is that you want to make you have to be able to make the case that this is money that's well invested, and so what you need to do, and I think this I think is an important task for people who are operating at the intersection of the studies of schooling and neighborhood, the sociologists who study neighborhood and people who are studying schooling, is you got to be able to make the case that that compensatory, if you want to think about it, that compensatory investment, more per pupil, higher per pupil expenditures in schools where kids come from less advantaged backgrounds than in schools where they don't. You've got to be able to make the case that investing that money in those schools is actually going to deliver you, you need something on the output side. You need to be able to show that investing that money in those schools is really going to do some good, and that the schools are not going to inherit, as people sometimes say, inherit the characteristics of the neighborhoods that they're in, and that what you're going to be doing is pouring more money down a hole. We're on the same team on this one. I just think that people who are on this team have to be able need to talk not only about you know, with backed by evidence, not just about the input side on education, but about why they expect there to be.
No, I agree with that. And, you know, Obama, as I said, in his talking about the need for accountability and appropriate instruments of assessment, touches on that, and that's been the kind of mantra in education policy for a long time. And from a policy management point of view, I mean, I see two aspects to what you just said. A political aspect, which is if we're going to get people behind it, we have to be able to persuade them. And also, yes, just from a sort of effective, yeah, policy. You don't want to throw money away, even if the money's available to be thrown away, and you want to be able to say what works and what doesn't work. And so accountability is important in that regard. Let me observe, however, that there are many areas of public life where huge sums are spent, where I wonder, you know, how accountable it is. I mean, we could ask about the military budget.
Yeah,
we,
yeah, yeah.
Just to take,
yeah,
a random,
yeah,
case,
yeah, yeah,
we could pick over the $500 billion. We could look at all the contracts that have been let, and we could ask ourselves about accountability. And then the question would arise as to why is it that I hear the accountability cry so loud and fervent? Why is it that the specter, that some educator somewhere might, some union,
yeah,
somewhere might pocket something, a little bit of surplus over what they otherwise would have gotten, skimming a little something. I'm not for this, but I'm just saying, is it the end of the world? Shouldn't we be willing to take some risks in that regard, I'm saying, and perhaps preaching to the choir, you know, on behalf of these goals? And the other thing I want to say, Josh, is that it's not just the schools.
Yeah.
I mean, in his Chicago speech about the family, which I, you know, kind of liked and kind of didn't like. Every parts I liked, and I'm talking,
yeah,
about,
yeah,
Obama now. He said something
I
liked.
Last man standing, no question you're talking about him. Yeah, go ahead.
Right, couldn't be talking about anybody else. He said something I like a lot, almost in passing. Having nurses visit on a regular basis with indigent mothers after they've had their newborn to help to instruct the mothers and guide them in how to be a mother, how to best take, you know, breastfeeding and all of that, nutrition and all of that, cognitive stimulation and all,
right,
of that, and all the other complexities. This is actually something that's been studied. Back in the 80s, there were a number of field experiments where the nurse visitation intervention was tried out on a random sample of people and not tried on others, and they were compared. And quite systematically, the programs were shown to have substantial and, you know, cost-effective, positive benefits on the mothers who were able to avail themselves of that. It's something that's done in other countries. It's, you know, it's the kind of thing that we could do. You know, you could talk about other, you know, you talk about,
yeah,
preschool education. You could talk about nutrition. You could talk about lengthening the school day and, you know, other kinds of activities for youngsters to help them in the process of development. But, you know, it doesn't have to just be the school,
right,
is what I'm saying.
I mean, all of this requires a belief in, you know, a belief in a set of convictions about the capacity of, you know, public policy to do some good. And, I like about Obama, and like about him more than I like about Bill Clinton, and is that he, you know, that's the Kool-Aid he's been drinking. He understands all the worries about troubles you can get into when you try to address problems that you can't address through public policy. But he understands, and this really, I think the most important thing that he stands for, one of several very important things, arguably the most important thing that he stands for politically, is a reaffirmation of that old conviction that it's possible to address problems that we have both in the country and, for that matter, globally, through some kind of rational, reasonable, intelligent, concerted action by, among others, and importantly, governments. And that idea has been under pretty consistent assault, as we both have been living in the same country for a while. That idea has been pretty consistently under assault, at least since the Reagan years. And I think for somebody to,
yeah,
stand up, and that's what I think the audacity of hope is about, insofar as it's not bullshit and drinking Kool-Aid and saying change and we're the change that you,
okay,
were or whatever. All the, there is that idea, and I think it's a very important one. And there's a very, just on the, to connect this to this, the issue.
But then here's my concern, or here's my question. Paul Krugman's recent column, I think it was today.
Absolutely.
You saw it.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, you see what I'm saying? Is Obama going to be Ronald Reagan, which is to say a transformative politician who really shifts the agenda, Reagan in a conservative direction, Obama in a progressive direction, or is Obama going to be Bill Clinton, which is to say, Bill, slick and effective politician who manages to win the electoral game, but doesn't really accomplish all that he might have and certainly doesn't transform, you know, so Sean Wilentz can write a book called The Age of Reagan, 1974 to 2008, you know, and Bill Clinton's administration didn't really stop the age of Reagan. He says, which is it going to be? And then he says, Krugman, that, well, if you run a campaign where you really put that vision out front and you articulate, I'm paraphrasing now, you know, exactly what it is that constitutes your revolutionary program, then maybe when you get elected, you have the mandate, right. You have the support, you've sort of been the kind of public communicator who allows that that program to be moved more into action. And I'm just wondering in this campaign when we're going to stop moving to the center and, playing this electoral game, which is a game that has to be played, and find time to articulate in some more, you know, than airy and, kind of vague terms exactly what this transformation consists in.
A couple of things on that. First of all, I did read the Krugman column, and I thought it was very good. I thought it was a very sensible, smart column by somebody who's obviously not been a big Obama enthusiast, but I thought it was, this was not hostile. It was, I think, an important, make a very important point. Second thing, I think you have to be a little bit careful on the historical lessons here. So here's my, not completely tutored, but I think accurate historical perception, which is if you compare the Reagan's race in 1980, where it was pretty clear that he wanted to do something pretty fundamentally different, and then came in and, went to town. Compare that with Roosevelt in 32.
I see you came in talking very conventionally
and
ended up being very
radical. Did something, because circumstances called for it, they hit the ground running, and that's a case where the Krugman point, which is that you have to run to govern, not just run to win. I think it's,
that's a common example.
I think it's a little bit, but I still think that there's something to this. I think there's something to this, to the point that he was making. I think also that, there's an interesting recent book, very interesting recent book by Larry Bartels called Unequal Democracy, The Political Economy of the New Gilded Age. And I don't know if you know Larry at all. He is among them.
I know the reputation, and I've heard about the book, but I haven't had a chance to look at it
yet. Well, he's a fantastically smart political scientist who studies American politics, who's as good a an empiricist as pretty much anybody else around. And I won't go through the entire argument of the book, although I do recommend it. I think it's a very fine book. The reason I mention it is because one of the things that Bartels emphasizes is that there's a huge difference, no matter who the Democrat is who's elected, there's a huge difference for people in the bottom quintile between electing a Democrat and electing a Republican. In terms of income, where does the income growth go? Much better if you're in the bottom quintile. Much better to have a Democrat elected.
And this is based on what, post World War II
Post World War II. There is the data problem that you mentioned earlier, and this is about income. It's not about opportunity. Okay, but
yeah.
It, but, income dispersion, income inequality, grows a lot more under Republicans than it does under Democrats. And that's not because income dispersion is growing, but the rising tide, is lifting all ships, and people at the bottom are doing even better, even as the dispersion is growing. No. But basically, if you like income equality, you want to have a Democrat. If you like growth, if you're a Rawlsian and you like growth in the bottom quintile, income growth in the bottom quintile, you want a Democrat. And the point is that this is true regardless of whether you're a audacity of hope, Democrat, or just a kind of, win the election, get into power kind of Democrat. And so, I think I don't know whether, who knows whether Obama is going to deliver on the promise that some people see in him, which is, as I say, I think ultimately a promise to restore some sense of confidence in the capacity of the political system, meaning the people, to address important collective problems and to do that both domestically and globally. Whether he'll deliver on that, I think, is not so clear. But in terms of just, some pretty basic stuff, like how well off, how well people in the bottom quintile fare, that I think is reason enough, given how badly they have been faring. That's reason enough to think it would be a good idea to have him in the White House.
Okay.
The one thing that I just on the audacity of hope, the one thing since we're running out of time, we're not going to get to this. But the one,
Take a moment because is it campaign finance?
We could talk about campaign finance if you'd like. Yeah. Or I was going to say that a disappointment that I'm feeling with Obama is that I don't think he's taken the opportunity to say that. that when we think about trade in the United States, we should think about the benefits for people in other countries too. There hasn't been enough, and this is somebody who's got the kind of some kind of globalist sensibility in some ways, but I don't think that when the policy arguments have hit the ground, as in the trade area, that very simple point that we have a big market and that we can help people.
Josh, I've got to interrupt you. I'm sorry. My phone is telling me the battery will go dead momentarily, so we're going to get cut off soon. I think we probably should sign off if we're going to do it properly.
Glenn, good to talk.
So the next time we talk, I want an answer to my question. Barack opted out of the public financing. There's been a lot of talk about this. Is it okay, and you're a political scientist, is it okay to buy elections as long as you pay with small bills?
Okay. We'll start there next time.
That's what I want to talk about.
Right.
Okay. Bye.
Now.